Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order, and what we're going to do is we're going to have public hearings first, but before I actually start those, I am going to open up a work session for Senate Bill 1007, and that's purpose of opening up the work session is to carry that over till tomorrow, waiting for amendments to be drafted, and hopefully everything will be in place for tomorrow. So Senate Bill 1007 will be carried over until tomorrow, Tuesday, February 9th. And now we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing. I'm going to do a joint public hearing on SJR 43 and SB 1018.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1018 SJR 43 authorizes sobriety checkpoints on the passage of SJR 43, which is a referral to the voters to amend the Constitution to allow sobriety checkpoints. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so we have a number of individuals that are wanting to testify today. I want to start off with Senator Monroe. And Rod, did you have anyone that you wanted to bring up with you?
Would be nice.
Whoever you'd like to bring up.
Anita Howard is the historian on this issue and probably the most renowned traffic safety person in the whole state of Oregon. And she had a traffic problem getting here this morning, so I'm glad to be here with you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Senator Rod Monroe. You have my written testimony, I believe.
It's coming out right now.
I duly had 25 copies prepared. I represent Senate District 24, which is in Multnomah County and Northern Clackamas County. Senate Joint Resolution 43 will allow the voters of the state of Oregon to determine whether or not law enforcement agencies should be allowed to use sobriety checkpoints to reduce the number of impaired drivers on our highways. The issue of sobriety checkpoints has never been voted on by the people of the state of Oregon. If voters approve the measure, law enforcement agencies will have the discretion to use sobriety checkpoints, or not if they don't want to. The 38 states that currently permit sobriety checkpoints have seen a 20% reduction in highway fatalities and serious injuries. This would mean that we would be saving the lives of 30 Oregonians per year and 2,100 fewer serious injuries. Over 150 fewer ER visits per month would save Oregonians millions of dollars in health care costs. Whenever the issue has been polled, a vast majority of Oregonians support giving law enforcement agencies this important tool. Sobriety checkpoints only delay motorists 2 or 3 minutes. The primary advantage of sobriety checkpoints is as a deterrent. This is why we see such a significant reduction in fatalities and serious injuries. Sobriety checkpoints were conducted in Oregon prior to 1986. I spent a night on one, seeing how they work. A woman in Eugene was stopped at a sobriety checkpoint in 1982. She sued and lost her case in Lane County Circuit Court. She appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and they reversed the circuit court decision in 1986. A year later, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld the Court of Appeals decision. Since then, law enforcement agencies have not been allowed to conduct sobriety checkpoints in Oregon. In 1990, a Michigan case was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The court ruled that sobriety checkpoints were legal and constitutional. In a recent case, Indiana's Supreme Court ruled that sobriety checkpoints were legal. Indiana's state constitution has the exact same wording as Oregon with respect to search and seizure. When they were writing the Oregon Constitution, they actually copied the language from the Indiana state constitution. So the fact that Indiana has now determined that that language does not forbid sobriety checkpoints, I believe, is important. Sobriety checkpoints are an important tool to keep our streets safe from dangerous, impaired drivers. It's time for the voters of Oregon have an opportunity to decide on whether or not they support sobriety checkpoints. Your companion bill, Senate Bill 1018, simply will implement the act if it is approved by voters. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to respond to questions, or you might want to hear from Anita Howard first, and then we'll both take questions.
Senator Monroe, it sounds like you have time to stay with us for a little bit.
I have time.
Okay. Ms. Howard, do you want to go ahead and go next?
Thank you. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anita Howard, and I am a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. But I should maybe give you a little bit of background, since the Senator referred to me as a historian in this area. I'm almost afraid to admit that I began working in the highway safety movement in this state in 1950. Bill has been discussed. I first began writing about it in 1993. That was after I had retired as a state employee. But I had long supported and believed in sobriety checkpoints and had indeed helped make sure that some of them were conducted in the state before that Supreme Court decision occurred. The last time I checked, sobriety checkpoints are authorized in at least 38 states in this country. And I think it's rather interesting to notice that of the holdouts, almost half of them, in fact, half of them, are all out west. We still have, I guess, our strong independence feeling out here. The literature that I've reviewed over the years says that we can reduce fatalities in about 20% if we support and have sobriety checkpoints. And the true value of those checkpoints is really not in making arrests. And lots of people seem to think that's their only purpose. That's their last purpose. The first purpose is deterrence. And the only way a sobriety checkpoint really works effectively if they're very well publicized before they occur. The Senator referred to some public opinion polls. In 1986, before the Supreme Court decision here, a public opinion poll conducted in Oregon said, do you think police should increase or decrease the current number of sobriety checkpoints? And 57% of the respondents said they thought checkpoints should be increased. 17% said they thought they should be decreased, and 15% thought they should maintain the current level, and 10% of the respondents didn't know, period. Now, that was 26 years ago, and the support was pretty strong for them. The most recent survey I've seen was in 2008, and despite the fact that we have had no checkpoints since that court ruling, the people seemingly still support the use of these strategies. The respondents were asked to rate on a scale of 1 to 5 how effective they believed several actions would be in reducing the instances of drunk driving in Oregon. Even though Oregon has not used them for more than 20 years, 61% of those surveyed said they believed sobriety checkpoints would be effective or very effective in reducing the instances of drunk driving in Oregon. Now, some have said the saturation patrols that we do have are just as effective as sobriety checkpoints. The research I've seen does not support that conclusion because the two techniques have different goals. The goal of a saturation patrol is to catch, arrest, and prosecute drivers who break all traffic laws, including but not limited to DUII. The goal of a sobriety checkpoint is to deter the type of behavior, driving under the influence, that leads to arrests for that specific charge. And that's one reason why well-publicized checkpoints are essential to success. I think our Chair Chuck Hayes can speak to some sobriety checkpoint experience he's had, that indicates people do respond to that deterrence effect and take steps to avoid driving under the influence. We think SJR would provide a way for Oregonians to have a say on the use of sobriety checkpoints. And once again, we urge your support for sending this issue to a vote of the people. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to open up for questions at this point, and Senator Wissett, and then it looks like you're ready to go. Okay, and then we'll just work this way.
Welcome today. I had done a little research on this and regarding the United States Supreme Court decision. In his dissenting opinion, Justice Stevens said, and I quote, "The findings of the trial court based on an extensive record and affirmed by the Michigan Court of Appeals indicate that the net effect of sobriety checkpoints on traffic safety is infinitesimal and possibly negative." Would you comment on that?
Well, Senator, I'm not a lawyer, and I know that lawyers quite often can disagree on
these decisions.
I think all the research that I've seen points out that sobriety checkpoints are effective and do indeed reduce the incidence of drunken driving. They may not increase the number of arrests, but they deter people from driving under the influence, where they're well publicized, and I think the research I've seen at least indicates that that conclusion is correct.
I thank you for that. But Justice Stevens did say that it was the net effect on traffic safety. The net effect on traffic safety is infinitesimal or possibly negative, is what he said. So thank you.
Senator Michi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. I wanted to ask about the saturation patrols, and I'm glad you brought that up in your testimony because I was going to ask about it, and then I saw you had addressed it. You talked about the research having does not support the conclusion because they have different goals. And I wanted to ask, first of all, if we could get some of that research, if you have it handy or can refer us to that research. I'd like to take a look at it. And it seems that there must be some goal of deterrence because I hear about saturation patrols on the radio quite a bit. They're, especially around holidays, they always tell you we're going to have increased patrols out there. So it seems that part of the intent is to deter. So I just wonder if you could comment on that.
Senator, I think you're correct. Saturation patrols do have a deterrent effect, but they are more broadly aimed at all kinds of violations, speed violations, following too close. In other words, they're out trying to catch those who are violating all of the traffic laws, not just looking for people who may be driving under the influence of some kind of an intoxicant. I'm not a police officer. Are effective, but for different purposes. They do catch some drunk drivers, that's true, but the idea of a well-publicized sobriety checkpoint is to deter people from driving while they're drinking, period. Some of the most recent experience we've had about sobriety checkpoints was just yesterday. The fact that people were aware that people, that they were going to be looking for people who were under the influence caused, I think, a lot of people to stop drinking sooner or get a designated driver, and that's without even having sobriety checkpoints.
Thank you. And just to follow up, I would be interested in, you say the research does not support that conclusion. I'd be really interested in seeing that, so thank you.
I will dig through my file.
Terrific. Thank you.
Can I comment, Mr. Chair?
You may.
Sobriety checkpoints and saturation patrols are two tools available in most states to law enforcement. In this state, they only have one. Sobriety checkpoints, if this measure were passed by the voters, would not be required of any law enforcement agency. It would simply be a tool in their toolbox, and they could use whichever tool they thought was most effective. So whether it be OSP or the Portland Police or county sheriffs or whatever, if they want to have a sobriety checkpoint, they would. If they don't want to and they want to just continue saturation patrols, then they would have that option. Nothing in this measure would force law enforcement agencies to conduct sobriety checkpoints. But it is interesting that virtually all of the police agencies that I've talked to are in support of this measure.
All right, I think that's all the questions. I have 2 points I was going to make based on what I've heard in testimony, and one of them being a public service announcement. That public service announcement, I read in today's paper that for the next 2 weeks, police officers throughout the state will be doing saturation patrols. They're going to be doing saturation patrols for speeding, impaired drivers, and seat belts. So for all those out there on the roads for the next 2 weeks, you've got your public service announcement.
And cell phones.
That was not in my paper, but I assume cell phones are probably going to be one, too. The other thing is just a note in Senator Monroe's testimony. He talks about how the Indiana Supreme Court ruled on sobriety checks as points being legal using the same language that our Supreme Court previously said not. So I guess you can have difference of opinions of interpretation. Showing where even states that have the same language in their constitution can come to a different conclusion. So with that, thank you all very much.
I'll just add to the effectiveness of that. When I was away home from the airport around midnight, I passed 8 stops with lights flashing and 11 police cars. I have never in my life on the route back from the airport seen so many police officers on the road at that time of night.
Well, last night was something about Super Sunday night, I think, too.
Super Bowl party, you know.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Our next panelists are going to be Ann Pratt and Chuck Hayes.
I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Parents of Murdered Children, Crime Victims United, and I'm also a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm here to represent Mothers Against Drunk Driving, CVU, and Parents of Murdered Children in support of SJR 43 and Senate Bill 1018. In my testimony, I sheet, and it covers the cost of drunk driving in Oregon in the year 2007. If you'll notice, it's alcohol only, and they use the figure of 150 fatalities, each costing $1,210,000. That would be a total then of $181 million. That is the economic cost only. Which is medical costs, hospital, physician, police, fire, ambulance, property damage, helicopter service, coroner, premature death, burial. Medical insurance and loss of productivity in the workplace. The second figure is a total estimate. Economic cost of crashes plus the quality of life losses. The estimate on that is around $600 million. And that's described as losses, places a dollar value on the pain, suffering, and the loss of quality of life plus the loss to the families who experience the death. The Center for Disease and Control and Prevention found that sobriety checkpoints can reduce alcohol-related crashes and fatalities by 20%. Using 2008 impaired driving statistics and the $1,210,000 figure from the MAD fact sheet, per each fatality, that would mean that we could save somewhere between 30 and 46 people per year. And also a cost savings of $55 million. Studies have also consistently found that societal savings from checkpoints significantly outweigh the initial investment, up to $23 for each dollar invested. And a 2005 Gallup poll shows 87% of the public are in favor of sobriety checkpoints. I urge you to forward these two life-saving bills and actually dollar-saving bills and allow Oregonians to have a say on sobriety checkpoints. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Chuck?
Good morning, Senator, and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm here today providing testimony in support of SJR 43 and Senate Bill 1018 on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Our committee has long urged that the changes proposed in both of these measures and support these, and we have through the years. Our committee believes that sobriety checkpoints are a common sense approach to deterring impaired driving. You've heard some statistics this morning, and we know that research tells us that one out of every 10 Americans will likely be involved in an alcohol-related crash sometime in their lifetime. And those statistics seem to hold true to even today and continue. We believe that a person checked at a sobriety checkpoint, even though it might be a little bit of an inconvenience, when you weigh that against the loss of maybe losing a loved one or a friend or a family member due to an alcohol-related crash, it is more, more Americans would rather have the sobriety checkpoint than they would the loss of a life. Critics want us to believe that sobriety checkpoints are a nuisance and they're a poor use of taxpayers' money and an ineffective means of actually deterring and apprehending impaired drivers. But in actuality, sobriety checkpoints are play an important role in preventing impaired driving. I can speak personally of this because after I spent 30 years with the Oregon State Police, and in the mid-80s, I was a sergeant here with the Oregon State Police in the Salem area and actually coordinated a number of sobriety checkpoints. And one of the first ones conducted in Salem was one that we did just north of Salem on Shamauer Road, where it crosses over the top of Interstate 5. And on that particular night, we publicized the sobriety checkpoint. We started about a week in advance, excuse me, publicizing that. And so we started receiving a number of telephone calls. In fact, it literally turned into hundreds of telephone calls, people wanting to know when and where and what night we were going to do it and what times. We didn't divulge that information, just the fact that we were going to do a sobriety checkpoint. I took 8 troopers with me. And in less than 2 hours, we had 8 people under arrest for driving under the influence who had come through the checkpoint. So we weren't even actually able to finish the checkpoint because we ran out of personnel to continue the checkpoint. But I think one of the most important things about that checkpoint is that people that were coming through the checkpoint, they knew that they had heard, well, they had heard about the checkpoint. And so a lot of those folks had taken preventative measures by making sure that they had a sober designated driver that night. Unfortunately, 8 of those drivers had not taken that approach and were arrested. After that, we had an opportunity to do a number of other sobriety checkpoints here in the Salem area. And again, they were very successful, not only from the prevention standpoint, because when you weighed the operation of the checkpoint versus traffic fatalities in Marion County, on each one of those that we did, I can say that there were no traffic fatalities that occurred over that that weekend. And so that, to me in itself, is something that is very productive and very effective. We also believe that you've heard, I think, testimony that 38 states utilize sobriety checkpoints, and Oregon is one of those 12 that do not. But we feel like that sobriety checkpoints, what they do more than anything is that they actually increase a driver's perception or their perceived risk of being arrested. And that's what we're really trying to do with sobriety checkpoints. You've heard a lot of talk this morning about saturation patrols versus checkpoints. And I can tell you that at checkpoint, people do feel like that there is an additional perception that they could be arrested if they're under the influence and driving. With saturation patrols, and you heard Senator Boquist talk about the number of vehicles that were working for the Super Bowl saturation, you take a number of officers, as many as you can, and then you say, okay, we're going to saturate an area for a certain time period. And so we have to look for things to stop those people for driving violations. And at sobriety checkpoint, we'll then determining however you have the mechanism set up of checking those vehicles, if it's every driver or every fifth driver or every third driver, you have a contact, a face-to-face contact with that driver. And so no violations are witnessed, they just come through. You have that short contact with them, and then if you can, if the officer perceives something or there's something that would maybe alert them to the possibility of impairment in that driver, then you continue the discussion. If you do not see that, well, then you release them. And so really we're looking at about maybe 60 seconds, maybe 90 seconds, so a minute and a half that you might have someone at a sobriety checkpoint, and then they move on through the checkpoint. So it's really, truly not that much of an inconvenience. And a sobriety checkpoint allows us to actually have that face-to-face contact with a greater number of motorists than we would with a saturation patrol. When I think of saturation patrols and the effectiveness, I do work now on a national basis with many states, and I was actually involved in a sobriety checkpoint, a saturation patrol, that was down in Phoenix, Arizona, where they literally have 300 officers out working in the county. And so you're truly saturating an area. In Oregon, we don't have that luxury of having that many officers where we can actually do a true saturation patrol. So there is quite a bit of difference when you actually talk about a saturation versus a sobriety checkpoint. So in summary, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, we support the two measures here today, and we just feel that this is another way of making our roadway safer and also sending a clear message that we are doing whatever we can here in Oregon so that we can prevent the needless loss of lives and injuries that are a result of impaired driving incidents. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? And I have one question.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you could tell me, has there ever been any discussion within MAD or any other organizations to try to go directly to the people through an initiative process?
Not that I recall, since I've been active.
Senator Wissa?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. The Oregon Constitution requires probable cause affirmed by oath, describing the place and person or thing to be searched prior to making contact to stop and search them. In your mind, how does this jive with the Oregon Constitution, that clause of the Oregon Constitution?
Well, when Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, when an officer contacts and makes that face-to-face contact with a motorist, well, the officer is trained to look for certain things, and it would be like a lack of coordination, fumbling with the driver's license or registration, maybe slow
speed. I understand that, but he has already stopped even on a sobriety checkpoint. He's already stopped the car. He's already made the contact before he makes that observation.
That is correct, sir.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be, I believe it's Dave Summons, Andrea Meyer, and Bob Holman. All right. Well, okay. You weren't planning on speaking? You are now.
You are. None of us are.
I assure you are. What we try to do is get everyone up at one time, make it a little more efficient.
There was a group of people at the bottom of the list that I sort of added my name, and I thought you were including me among them.
Can you give us your name?
I am once again appalled to find a Mr. proposal Summons. Such as this before
Mr.
the legislature.
Mr. Summons, I need you to just put on the record your name for yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dave Simmons, and I am a mere citizen.
Thank you.
I don't belong to any panels, and I don't advise anybody, I don't think.
You're advising us, and we're glad you're here.
I would hope so. I am once again appalled to find a proposal such as this before the legislature once again. Apparently, someone must think that because all the legislation that's been enacted thus far to stop drunk drivers from killing innocent people has been ineffective, what we should now do is to have the police stop everyone on the road. Rather than asking why all of our attempts thus far have failed so miserably, whoever is proposing this apparently would rather just hack away further at our freedoms. Frankly, the really appalling thing about this is not so much the content of the bills as the fact that we're actually electing people to our legislatures who can, in good conscience, apparently, support this kind of police state measure. If you really wanted to stop people from driving drunk, you could start by permanently incarcerating the repeat offenders. But just as is the case with repeat sex offenders, the policies with which our public officials inflict us are less concerned with protecting our freedoms and with forgiving and attempting to rehabilitate criminals whom we are tediously admonished have just made a mistake or are afflicted with a disease which renders their behavior beyond their control. Apparently, it's preferable to punish the innocent along with the guilty in the interest of giving the drunks and sex offenders yet another chance to redeem themselves, and no matter how many chances they've already had. It's easier to sell the public on putting up with a minor little inconvenience, one buzzword that I keep hearing, amidst constant reinsurances such as, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, than it is to adopt a firm moral position and hold offenders responsible for their own actions. Meanwhile, amidst all the excuses and waffling and specious pontificating, our freedoms are inexorably evaporating away. In fact, even more than merely punishing the innocent along with the guilty, what this particular type of legislation does is to introduce the presumption of guilt. Since we're now going to just put up a roadblock and stop everyone, the implication is that anyone driving down the road is presumed to be drunk unless he or she can prove otherwise. That, in particular, seems to me to be a dangerous legal precedent to be setting, but after all, what do I know? Perhaps most significantly, what our legislatures never seem to realize is that when they enact such measures, allowing the police to stop and search us at random, tagging and registering us like cattle with more and more restrictive ID requirements, and screening us when we attempt to purchase whatever items are deemed by the state to be dangerous this week, there are truly diabolical future consequences. Measures such as this are not just tools, another cute little buzzword I keep hearing, for law enforcement. Whether by accident or design, such measures are building blocks of an eventual police state of a sort which has never been seen before and under which I assure you, you will not want to live. The opportunity still remains here and now for us to turn back before it is too late, but is rapidly fading, and in particular, as a result of the panicked enactment of so-called security measures in the wake of recent events, and I don't need to remind anybody. It will be possible in the future to easily connect the dots between our present adoption of all of these so-called modest measures and innocuous tools, which again we are blandly assured will just cause minor inconveniences at worst, and the condition in which future generations will find themselves, but by then it will be too late. For instance, in the present case, allowing the police to gratuitously stop people and check them for alcohol consumption will eventually lead to blanket inspections for other things as well, in fact, for anything the state deems to be dangerous at the moment. Those of us in this room will probably not live long enough to see the end result, but your descendants will undoubtedly curse your memory for not having prevented it while there was still a chance to do so. It won't surprise me in the least to see the legislature pass this on as a ballot measure or to see it become law in the aftermath of the inevitable shrieking media campaign replete with weeping victims of drunken drivers and pious invocations of the children and your safety. If the American people want to give up their freedom for the inevitably false promise of more security, I suppose that's their right, although a lot of us personally resent being unwillingly dragged down to the abyss while warning of what the end result will be. I would, of course, hope that what was supposed to have been a republic, the legislatures would at least attempt to exert some moderating influence in the matter on behalf of future generations. But if you want to hand the people the change with which to bind themselves and then wash your hands of the responsibility, leaving their fate up to the whim of the majority at the time, I suppose that's equally your right. Nevertheless, I am reminded of one state legislator in another state who, in the aftermath of the passage of the Real ID legislation that's going around, was astounded to find out that his adorable little niece couldn't renew her driver's license because of irregularities in her birth certificate. The possibility that such legislation might turn around and bite him or someone he knew was apparently beyond his comprehension when he voted for it. So please, at least do us a favor. And don't let us hear our legislators complaining if, as a result of this legislation, it happens to be your child or grandchild who gets yanked out of her car and has her face stomped into the dirt by a police boot. Remember, it's all just a minor inconvenience for her protection, of course. anybody has any questions, I'll try to answer them.
All right, thank you for the prompt. Any questions for Mr. Simmons? All right, thank you very much for coming forward today and giving us your views on life.
Should I go back there now?
You may.
I'm not familiar with protocol.
Yeah. Who would like to follow up?
Chair Przomski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to both Senate Bill 1018 and SJR 43. This proposal is necessary because of the Nelson v. Lane County 1987 Oregon Supreme Court case that ACLU sponsored, holding that checkpoints violate Article 1, Section 9, our search and seizure equivalent to the Fourth Amendment. You know, the basic rationale that I think you've already discussed is that individuals should be free from seizure by the police unless there's probable cause to believe that individual has violated the law. Now, I think it's informative, although we have not had a ballot measure on Article 1, Section 9, to look at the most recent ballot measures that have come before Oregonians related to the Bill of Rights, and specifically Article 1, Section 8, the free expression provision of the Oregon Constitution, has been voted on four times in the last, I'd say, about 20 years. Three of those times were on adult businesses and restricting them, and the last time was on campaign finance. I think informative particularly is the fact that the campaign finance amendment to Article 1, Section 8 went down, although the issue was so popular that its companion statute was passed. And I think the reason for that is that Oregonians are rather protective of their Bill of Rights and ensuring that it is not tinkered with and amended, even when some of the suggestions as to the reasons why might be popular. Another problem with the sobriety checkpoints is I believe they are not effective use of scarce law enforcement resources. It costs a lot to question thousands of innocent people while drivers who do pose a danger avoid visible and well-advertised roadblocks. So the facts in Nelson briefly are illustrative to this issue. Back in December 1982, Ms. Nelson attended the Eugene Mayor's Christmas party as part of the staff, and she arrived around 6:30, had one drink with hors d'oeuvres around 7, then ate dinner, had coffee and dessert, and left around 10:15 to return to her home in Marcola. As she drove up Interstate 105 with a passenger, they were in fact passed by a vehicle that was driving in a weaving and erratic manner, and they pulled back and were quite concerned. I suspect back in 1982 we didn't have cell phones where we could quickly call law enforcement to alert. So when she got to Marcola Road, she noticed the flashing lights up ahead and about 6 to 10 patrol vehicles from the Oregon State Police and the Lane County Sheriff's. There's a long line of cars, and it took about 15 minutes before she reached the front. She thought there might have been a prison break, but she was informed otherwise that this was a sobriety checkpoint. And asked her when she last had her drink. She said she had last had a drink at 7 o'clock. She explained that she ate after that. Her friend leaned over and said to the trooper, well, there was someone back on 105 who was actually driving drunk. And again, the officer asked her when she last had a drink and decided to pull her forward, have her step out of the car, and engage in a number of field sobriety checkpoints during which throughout he kept asking her, when did she last have a drink? And she kept answering, 7 p.m. She passed all the tests because she was sober, and eventually she was allowed to go. The next morning, she called the ACLU of Oregon office in Eugene, and my executive director, Dave Fedenke, took the call. He's often testified on this, but I'm here today. And she was quite upset because she felt so strongly that the roadblocks had been a waste of public and police resources that actually made them less safe. And we agreed that the police should use and focus on drivers exhibiting visible signs of driving under the influence rather than stopping hundreds of innocent people who have done nothing wrong. It's not only a better use of resources, it's right now the constitutional requirements. So we filed a lawsuit and eventually won in the Oregon Supreme Court. And since then, while we have not ended the tragedy of drunk driving, we have done far better education in the last 25, 28 years, and we have strengthened Oregon laws. But because of funding shortfalls, we all know that police and law enforcement have suffered, and there are fewer patrol cars on the highway than there probably was in the 80s. But it is indisputable that sobriety checkpoints result in far fewer arrests per officer than either routine traffic patrols or saturation patrols, which you've heard discussed. The proponents of roadblocks argue that fewer numbers of arrests is proof of the effectiveness of checkpoints. The studies on this issue by roadblock advocates have shown that well-publicized enforcement efforts by police can have a deterrent effect on driving under the influence. Indeed, Ms. Howard, on page 2 of her testimony, states, quote, "The true value of checkpoints is not making Dewey arrest. The value comes because checkpoints deter the behavior itself." And interestingly, studies have shown, as you can imagine, that not all intoxicated people are actually stopped, are caught in roadblocks. Roadblocks, some cases, they don't check everyone, or in other cases, the person might not be showing a sign. But we believe these same effects can be attained by well-publicized saturation patrols, which the chair has added to today, and it has the following added benefits. You can do them on highways and locations where it's impossible to set up roadblocks. You can do them more frequently because of the lower cost. You can patrol for and stop other reckless activities such as distracted or cell phone use, and please do. And you will result in far more arrests of every kind of violation, including driving under the influence. For all these reasons, the ACLU urges you not to proceed on either of these proposals. Thank you.
Bob?
I am Bob Holman. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am also a criminal defense lawyer who has practiced for 28 years in this state. The Constitution is a document that should be timeless. It should not be subject to change simply because a judicial interpretation is unpopular with certain interest groups. Article 1, Section 9, which is our search and seizure clause, remains unchanged since 1857. It should remain intact. Oregon is one of 12 states that has ruled checkpoints unconstitutional by using a state constitutional analysis. Primarily, that is because roadblocks or checkpoints do not require an individualized suspicion based on articulable facts, which is the linchpin of constitutional stops. It is also because Article 1, Section 9 protects the privacy rights of Oregonians. Law enforcement already has sufficient tools in their toolbox to conduct vehicle stops. They can stop for traffic infractions based on reasonable suspicion. They can expand the scope of the stop if they come across additional evidence. They can stop a vehicle if they have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. They can search a stopped vehicle if there's probable cause of criminal activity inside that vehicle and the vehicle is mobile. They can conduct an inventory of the vehicle if the vehicle has lawfully been impounded. I want to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 1018, the companion bill. This bill purports to establish standards for sobriety checkpoints, but in reading Department of Transportation HS 807656, that is an aspirational standard. It simply allows agencies to promulgate their own rules using this document as a guideline. There would be no statewide uniformity, and we could end up with hundreds of different policies within the state of Oregon. This would lead to disparate treatment of Oregonians as well as increased and complicated litigation. In addition, this generalized policy doesn't prohibit the use of dogs to conduct searches. It does not prohibit excessive detention without reasonable suspicion. It does not prevent searches without probable cause. Amending the Oregon Constitution to allow sobriety checkpoints is not a good policy choice. The Oregon Supreme Court has decided that checkpoints violate the Oregon Constitution because they allow the state to interfere with a motorist's right to privacy. This is a fundamental right of Oregonians that should not be taken away. It is a principle that has been in effect and unchanged for 153 years. One thing I would like to add that I don't think anybody has brought up today is the fact that the Michigan case was decided by the United States Supreme Court that ruled that checkpoints were constitutional under the federal constitution. That case was sent back, remanded back to the state of Michigan, and Michigan decided that under their state constitution, they would, it didn't reverse, it It decided that under the state constitution, sobriety checkpoints were unconstitutional. So Michigan is one of the 12 states that does not allow sobriety checkpoints. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Yes, please.
Sir, what's that?
Thank you, Chair Kuczynski. After I sold my veterinary practice, I took a job with the Department of Agriculture, USDA, and we were worked in Mexico part-time for several months. And in Mexico, I traveled with private veterinarians over rural roads and over four Mexican states. And it wasn't uncommon, about once a week, we'd come around a sharp bend in the road or come over a hill, and there would be military or police on each side of the road with automatic weapons just before you came to the checkpoint. And we would be searched for our identification, our citizenship, and in many cases have everything taken out of the vehicle and checked just a general search. Mexico does not have a constitutional prohibition to search and seizure like we do in the United States. Do you think that this could be a first step to starting down a slope toward a police state like that?
It's entirely possible. As you can tell, I'm not an advocate of amending the Constitution by any means, and I think it's dangerous to even start down this slippery slope.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on SJR 43 or Senate Bill 1018? If you are here to give testimony on that one of those two bills or resolutions, please come forward at this time. Not seeing anyone stepping up, we'll close the public hearing on SJR 43 and Senate Bill 1018. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session now on Senate Bill 1049. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1049, or the Measure 49 fixes, the committee heard on February 4th. We had at that time in front of us a dash one amendment. I think we're just waiting for the fiscal and revenue statement. So the fiscal statement on the dash one is there's a fiscal statement issued and there's a no revenue impact on the dash one, and we need a subsequent referral to Ways and Means according to LFO.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment into SB 1049.
Senator Boquist moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1049 into the bill. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Request is subsequent.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move HB 1049 with the dash one in it as amended with a
request a subsequent referral.
With a request a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Request actually moves Senate Bill 1049 as amended by the dash ones.
do we want to do pass recommendation?
With a due pass recommendation to the President's office with the request for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Well, that's what I said, Mr. President. Mr.
I know that. That's why I said it again. If not, any objections? So ordered. And we don't need a carrier since it's going down.
That's right. No carrier.
All right, and we will, close that work session on SB 1049, open a work session on Senate Bill 1008.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1008 is the gun bill that we heard on February 4th. Yes. At the last meeting, I wanted to mention Senator Boquist mentioned an email that he sent to the committee, and that will be in the record for this committee meeting because we're discussing this bill at this time. This has the dash one amendment we discussed at that time. There's no revenue impact on the dash one and a minimal fiscal impact on the dash one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So at this point, the chair would entertain a motion for the dash ones in the Senate bill.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the dash one amendments for Senate Bill 1008.
Senator Dingfelder moves the dash ones in the Senate Bill 1008. Any discussion?
Just want to make sure I think from a policy position, I prefer the dash threes, so we can go on.
All right. Any other comments? Any objection to the adoption of the amendments dash ones into Senate Bill 1008? I see Senator Wissett and Senator Boquist both objecting. Any other objections? Not seeing any other objections, so ordered. And the dash ones are now part of the Senate Bill 1008.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1008 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 1008 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions?
Two questions, Mr. Chair. The fiscal in
yes.
regards to this?
Would you like me to describe the fiscal?
If you would, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the minimal fiscal on the dash one is due to the change from justice courts to circuit courts. OJD said that there will be a minimal fiscal because any of these petitions will now go to circuit court instead of justice court.
All right.
Do we have that?
The dash one? Or the fiscal? It just says minimal and just says okay. affected agencies, OJD. I do have it in my file if you want to look at
it.
Sorry,
but
they don't really just go into detail on that.
Any other questions or comments? Any objections to moving Senate Bill 1008 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I see Senator Wissett and Senator Boquist both objecting. It's so ordered, and it will go to the floor. I will carry the bill on the floor of the Senate. And at this point, I am going to make one statement for those who are tracking Senate Bill 1008 as to the reason I have supported the dash ones and the bill itself. It was my intent that when we passed Senate Bill 603 last session that had the part about an individual being able to get relief to not only purchase but actually to actually possess a weapon. It was my intent that it would actually extend to those individuals who had waited the time to allow for the 15 years to pass where they would not be considered a felon in possession. It did not make sense to me that a person would be able to purchase a weapon and not be able to possess. And I did not realize, as I've stated throughout this process, that the bill that we passed last session, 603, was as broad after it was drafted. As I've mentioned through our committee hearings, it came to my information as well as to the chair on the House side very, very late in the process after we had passed the bill between both chambers that there was this conflict. And at this point, I believe that Senate Bill 1008, as amended, does in fact bring the bill back to allow for those individuals who have in fact had that wait period to be able not only to purchase but to actually possess that gun. And I'm going to use one analogy here. I personally believe that there should be a wait period. I do not believe that someone, multi-felon or any single felon, should be able to petition the court immediately upon leaving custody of a prison or leaving or being off of post-prison supervision for immediate relief to possess a weapon. The example I would use is how we see expungements in this state. A person is not able to expunge their conviction for a minimum of 3 years, and I believe that there should, in fact, be a wait cooling down period before an individual who has been convicted of one or more felonies has the ability to possess a weapon in the state. That is a policy decision that I believe the voters of the state have, in fact, believed is the case. And what we are doing by passing Senate Bill 1008 as amended will, in fact, allow those individuals who have, in fact, met the criteria of a 15-year period to be able to possess that weapon. Now, lastly, I've told the advocates for the changes in 603 that I am more than willing and still am willing to sit down during the rest of this interim and setting up some type of a process that an individual could, in fact, be able to petition a court to regain their gun rights and possession rights back sooner. What I would envision is that there are numerous individuals who are, in fact, convicted of a certain type of felonies, which I do not believe pose a risk or a threat as others. And I do believe that we should, in fact, have some type of filtering of those type of felonies that seem to be ones that are not really necessary to interfere with a person's right to purchase or possess weapons to be able to do so. And so if the proponents want to work on that during this interim period, I will be more than glad and follow through with that. Any other comments or statements? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't necessarily disagree with anything you had to say. It's just a matter of the process and how we get there. And the other issue that's in here is the issue of vehicle definition for motorcycle, all-terrain vehicles, and snowmobiles, which, in my opinion, needs a little broader discussion with the people that are impacted with that. And with that, serve notice of a possible minority report, which before I put it forward, I will discuss with you.
Okay, that'd be great. Any other comments or statements? All right, thank you. So we will be closing the work session on Senate Bill 1008. And before we close the session today, Mr. Simmons, you're still here. I'm just going to tell you that I'm very pleased that you are willing to come forward and give us your opinion and your perspective. What I will tell you is that I respect your right to have your beliefs, to put them on record, to have redress before this committee or any other committee. And so I appreciate that. But I'm also going to tell you that I personally do not agree with many of your statements that you made. I do not believe that the vast majority of our law enforcement individuals that serve the state in such capacity would carry out the acts that you insinuated that would occur or does occur when a person is stopped in the state. So with that, I just want to make certain you understand I respect your ability to come here and speak, but also want to let you know as the chair of this committee, I disagree with your perspective on basically a broad brush stroke of all the men and women of law enforcement to be stormtroopers. All right, any other questions or comments? Colleagues, what we're going to do is tomorrow we're scheduled to start at 8. I'm going to put on the record again, we're going to start at 8:15. It seems like we have enough time to get through our work. I do want to leave enough time for tomorrow because I believe we have some more public hearings that we are doing, but instead of starting at 8 o'clock, we will be starting at 8:15. With that, if there's not anything else, we're adjourned for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.